morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ethiopia declares a state of emergency.
As you know, before 2 days, the regional government of the Amhara Regional State had also declared a regional state of emergency, but this one is now a national state of emergency, which means it would be applicable within all the 9 regional states except for the Tigray, which is now in conflict.
Young human rights ambassadors in Malawi want President Chakwera to fulfill his campaign promises. Zimbabwe launches a COVID-19 vaccination campaign for teenagers. Somali journalists say perpetrators of violence against journalists remain unpunished. And an Eswatini political leader says no to President Cyril Ramaphosa's proposal for dialogue.
We had requested SADC to send a peacekeeping force before we can even talk of a dialogue. And if he says it will be in 3 months' time, it doesn't seem like there's any urgency.
An activist will comment on deforestation talk at the COP26 summit. And the World Food Program says Madagascar may be suffering the world's first climate-induced famine. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An Ethiopian analyst says the declaration of a state of emergency announced Tuesday by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is only a precautionary measure to guide against Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, the TPLF infiltrators. Masembet Asefa, assistant professor of law at the Addis Ababa University School of Law, says Ethiopians, particularly residents of Addis Ababa, are not panicking because their national army is still very strong. Prime Minister Akme announced the state of emergency on Tuesday after TPLF forces said they were gaining territory and considering marching on Addis Ababa, the capital. The government also asked Addis Ababa residents to take up arms to defend their neighborhoods. Professor Asefa says there's no way the TPLF can ever come back to power after ruling the country for 29 years, marred by human rights abuses and corruption.
Today, the Ministry of Justice, the Minister Dr. Gedeon Timotheos, announced that there would be a nationwide state of emergency declared. As you know, before 2 days, the regional government of the Amhara Regional State had also declared a regional state of emergency, but this one is now a national state of emergency, which means it would be applicable within all the 9 regional states except for the Tigray, which is now in conflict.
When you say the government declare a state of emergency, what does that mean? Is it preparation for war, or what is the government telling the citizens?
Yes, but the thing is, you know, obviously, the security situation is very complex in Ethiopia currently. And after the withdrawal of the Ethiopian National Defense Forces from Tigray, insurgency continued and the conflict escalated to Amhara and Afar regions because they invaded both regions for whatever political cause they have. And before 2-3 days ago, they had also taken part of the cities in Kondolcha and Desie, which are very big cities, actually, in Amhara region. So, and I think the fear is that obviously there might be, you know, infiltrators and people who might give information and support to the rebel groups, and the government is taking precaution, which is understandable because some of the reports that came were that there were infiltrators in some of the cities that helped the rebels.
The government is telling these citizens, residents, to register their arms and also to prepare to defend their neighborhoods.
That announcement, the registration of arms, is in relation to Addis Ababa. Again, as you know, because of the complex security situation in this country, and Addis Ababa is also a very big city, there are people who have maybe guns who have not officially registered, which makes it very difficult for the government to trace and control maybe violent activities that may be preemptive. So again, another precautious measure by the government.
Do you see any urgency in terms of preparation by residents of Addis Ababa? What are they doing? Are they fearful? Are they trying to stock up on food? Or what are they doing?
It's not a panic moment, James, you know. You know, the National Army is still very strong. So it's not like things are out of hand. That's not, I think, some of the reporting they have in the international media, you know, like they are closing to Addis Ababa. That's completely false.
The TPLFS spokesperson, his name is Getachew Reda, said that if the Tigrayan forces and their allies succeed in removing the Ethiopian government, that they will establish an interim government. They are talking with confidence.
The funny thing is, you know, James, you have to know that TPLF, whatever political cause they have, even if you take the worst case scenario, personally, I don't think they will ever succeed in doing that. Because, you know, one thing they succeeded was they had now taken the shape of an ethnic kind of, they wanted to make it a kind of an ethnic conflict, now, which makes it very difficult actually for them. Because, you know, the Amharas, which are probably close to 50 million people, if you are antagonizing them, then it's very difficult actually for them to take control of Ethiopia. So it's going to be very dangerous actually, them coming to taking political power. But the most important thing is now, we are talking about, James, a political group that stayed and controlled state power for 27, 30 years and was extremely corrupt and violated significant human rights violations. So my worry, I don't know how they're going to, because there is no ideological shift. There is no new kind of narrative coming from their side.
Dr. Asefa, it's so nice always to speak with you.
It's a pleasure, James.
Dr. Masembet Asefa is the Assistant Professor of Law at the Addis Ababa University School of Law. You're speaking with us from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. A political leader in Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, says a proposal by South African President Cyril Ramaphosa for dialogue on the political and security crisis in the kingdom has no urgency. President Ramaphosa, chair of the Southern African Development Community, SADC Organ on Politics, met Tuesday in Mbabane with King Mswati III. He said the king, working with the SADC Secretariat, will work towards establishing a national dialogue forum, incorporating the structures enshrined in the Eswatini Constitution, including Sibaya and Parliament. Sibongile Mazibuko is the president of the Ungwane National Liberatory Congress, the NNCL, Eswatini's oldest political party. She said the pro-democracy movement had requested the deployment of a SADC peacekeeping force because the environment in Eswatini is not conducive for a dialogue spearheaded by King Mswati III.
It doesn't look like there is agency of what is taking place on the ground. People are dying. The army is pulling people outside their houses and violating them, and inflicting violence, stopping marches that are legal. Protests have been closed. People are intimidated. The environment is not conducive. We had requested SADC to send a peacekeeping force before we can even talk of a dialogue. And if he says it will be in 3 months' time, it doesn't seem like there's any agency. It doesn't look like SADC is ready to intervene into this impasse.
President Ramaphosa said that the discussion or the dialogue should take place in the context of Sibaya. What does that mean for you and the other stakeholders?
Not just that. He said it is going to be the government that will decide the composition of the forum. And when you talk about political parties, the constitution allows for political parties to exist, but registration has been denied by the government. They are neither allowed to participate in elections. The Sibaya dialogue has never borne any fruits. People that go there to make submissions are later victimized. They are pulled out of their houses. Fake charges are imposed on them. They will follow you so long as you are going to talk something that the king does not want to hear. So Sibaya is the forest where the system will hide and pretend there is dialogue. All resolutions taken there, it is up to him whether they should be implemented or not. Because then at Sibaya, he is Ingwenyama. He is worshipped there. He is God. He has the power of God. The last Sibaya that the king called, only a few hundreds attended Sibaya. Normally, if people used to call people, 3,000 would go there. But the last Sibaya, Maswati said they would never set their foot there again.
My understanding is that the stakeholders had requested or had said that they prefer an international-type mediation. If you think that there's no urgency in the statement of the South African president representing SADC, what is the way forward in terms of mediation or dialogue?
The way forward is that we had requested SADC to make sure that there is a peacekeeping to protect Emaswati. Emaswati, over 100 have died because they are armless, including women and children. People have bullet wounds in their body because there is no health facilities in the country. Schools are now have come to a stop. Nothing is working in the country. You cannot be saying that dialogue will start in 3 months when all institutions that are essential for the life of Emaswati are not working anymore due to the violence that is everywhere.
It's a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sibongile Mazibuko is president of the Ungwane National Liberatory Congress Party, the oldest political party in Eswatini. In Malawi, a group called the Young Human Rights Ambassadors have organized street demonstrations in the commercial capital Blantyre against what they say is President Lazarus Chakwera's failure to fulfill his campaign promises. The protesters want the Chakwera administration to create 1 million jobs, improve people's living standards, reduce presidential powers and passport fees as promised during his campaign last year. The protest followed public outcry over the high cost of living Malawians are facing following recent hikes in commodity prices, largely blamed on recent increase in fuel prices. Lamek Masina reports.
The civil society group known as Human Rights Ambassadors led the protests that attracted heavy police presence. Among other issues, the protesters accused the current president, Lazarus Chakwera, of failing to fulfill promises he made during the campaign period last year. Steve Chimwaza led the protest.
They promised a lot. They promised rule of law. They promised us democracy. They promised us 1 million jobs. They promised us cheap licenses and passports. Nothing is there.
People in Malawi have been extremely frustrated because of skyrocketing prices of basic goods and services. Last month, the government increased the price of fuel by more than 20%. Which then caused the price hikes for other commodities. The government blamed the price hikes on the impact of COVID-19 and also the global increase in fuel prices. But Chimwaza says Malawians will not accept any excuses.
I want to take you back. It is Mr. President himself. He told Malawian in a vernacular language that if he fails, in 2 years he will resign. He gave us a time frame. But up to that, even 100,000 people have not employed.
Melen Kata was among the women who joined the protests. She said she already receives a low monthly salary and the recent price hikes in goods and services have led to her failing to pay school fees for her children. She said even buying soap is now becoming a problem. However, President Chakwera said recently that it is not realistic to expect his administration to fulfill all campaign promises within 1 year. Mustafa Hussein is a political science lecturer at the University of Malawi. He says the protesters' grievances are justified.
There is a limit to which the situation can be blamed to COVID, because COVID is it's a global pandemic. And there are some countries that seem to be progressing amidst COVID. Yeah, so government must take the responsibility on unfulfilled promises.
In their petition, the protesters are calling for the resignation of President Chakwera, his Vice President Saulos Chilima, National Assembly Speaker Gotani Hara, and Leader of Opposition Kondwani Nankuma if they fail to address their grievances. Blantyre City authorities received the petition from the protesters and promised to deliver it to the authorities for feedback. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 3rd. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government has launched a COVID-19 vaccination campaign among the country's teenagers. Public health experts welcome the move but want more resources set aside to import more vaccines in a country where only about 2.6 million people have been vaccinated since February. Columbus Mavunga reports.
Zimbabwe's acting health and child care minister, Amoni Murira, told journalists late Monday that the country had so far managed to vaccinate 38% of the population. He then announced the recommendation regarding those over the age of 16.
Based on the available scientific data, in line with the Medicines Controls Authority of Zimbabwe guidance, the specialist pediatricians have recommended the vaccination of the 16 to 17 years age group with the Sinovac COVID-19 vaccine. The protocol of the younger age groups is still under consideration. The ministry wishes to advise the public that COVID-19 vaccination of the 16 to 17 years age group has been approved. The government of Zimbabwe, through the Minister of Health and Child Care, is determined that Zimbabwe achieves herd immunity by end of December 2021.
Dr. Numen Matara, the head of Zimbabwe Association for Doctors for Human Rights, is hopeful the move would increase the number of people getting vaccinated and will push the country further to achieving herd immunity.
This is a welcome move, but we just hope that the vaccination will continue to be voluntary and that these teenagers will not be mandated to get vaccines in schools and colleges, but people should just continue to voluntarily get the vaccine.
Itairu Sike, head of non-profit community working group on health in Zimbabwe, commended the government for the announcement as it helps the country reach its target of vaccinating at least 10 million Zimbabweans, or 60% of the population, by the year end.
This is important in order to prevent the teenagers from COVID-19 infections, hospitalization, and even death, especially from the looming threat of the new Delta variants. It is also important that the school health coordinators are equipped with the necessary COVID-19 vaccine literacy so that they can then assist in educating the students, you know, the teachers and support staff on the importance of getting vaccinated. It is also important that the community leaders should play a critical role in being our, you know, COVID-19 vaccine champions and ambassadors, so that they can also encourage the parents and the children within their communities to embrace the vaccines.
Zimbabwe has fully inoculated just above 2.6 million people since February, when it began its vaccination program to contain the COVID-19 pandemic. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
On the United Nations International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists on November 2nd, Somalia's press freedom advocates are calling for justice. The Somali Journalist Syndicate says 12 journalists have been killed in the country from 2017 to the start of this year, and the group says more than 80% of their killers are roaming free. Mohamed Kahia reports from Mogadishu.
According to Somali Journalist Syndicate, an advocacy group working to advance media rights in the Horn of African nation, 12 journalists have been killed since February 2017, while more than 60 others were arrested from January to October 2021. Most of the perpetrators have not been brought before the court to face charges. SJS Secretary General Abdallah Mumin says the organization is worried about the deteriorating relations between the media and the security agencies in particular.
The cooperation between the state security forces and the media in general is non-existent in Somalia. The Somali federal government in September last year announced a special prosecutor for the crimes against journalists, but this was only a word from mouth and nothing has been done to implement it in a tangible way.
Hanat Ali Gulaid, editor of Mogadishu-based Kopchok Media Network, survived an attack in July and said he still faces threats based on his work. He said he was attacked heading home from work in Mogadishu by assailants he suspects are linked to the government agencies. He said he continues to receive constant threats from the group. The director of communications at Somalia's president's office, Abdulqadir Hashi, said in a tweet that the government will continue to speak out against anyone who obstructs the work of the press in the country. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists 2021 Global Impunity Index, Somalia has been the world's worst country for unresolved killings of journalists for 7 consecutive years. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
World leaders convening at the COP26 summit have declared halting deforestation a top priority, but activists are skeptical given past comments which they say have not been met. Joe Blackman, head of forest policy and advocacy at Global Witness, spoke to Ricky Stryak from Glasgow to discuss what the declarations mean and do not mean.
Deforestation. There's been a world leaders declaration on forests, or the Glasgow Declaration as it's being called, and that has seen more than 100 world leaders sign up to tackling deforestation, I think ending deforestation in fact by 2030. So that's a really, you know, kind of impressive range of support for action to tackle deforestation. There is some skepticism here though at the same time. We have seen commitments on deforestation before that haven't been met. In 2014, a smaller group of governments signed up to end deforestation by 2030 and halve it by 2020. They missed the 2020 deadline and are off track to meet the 2030 deadline.
When you say the accord and these agreements, what does that mean besides, you know, signing a piece of paper? How does that translate into practical application?
Sure. So I think the devil's going to be in the detail, really. And what they've released so far today is quite top line. So we are all looking forward to seeing more flesh on the bones and a bit more information about what is planned for, particularly for each of the countries, you know, both for the forest-rich countries, like some of those in the Congo Basin, also on the other hand, from consumer countries and those centres of global finance, which we know are also crucial. We know there is legislation under development in the UK and EU at the moment, which would look to do that. We want that. We think that's really important, but it needs to be strong and effective.
What about giants like the US and China? What can actually be done if big consumer countries don't get on board with, like you said, legislative and financial action?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So we're really keen to see what they have to say. We think that exactly that. We think both of those countries are really crucial to also take regulatory action. In the US, there is a draft bill that's been brought forward by Senator Schatz of Hawaii and a couple of other senators, I think, as well. And that does similar to what's on the table in the UK and shortly will be in the EU. So again, that's this type of legislation that looks to require companies to make sure they're not importing goods that have been grown on land that's been illegally deforested.
The moratorium was kind of officially lifted in DRC on logging, and then the lifting of the moratorium was suspended. Has there been much global discussion on the moratorium of logging in DRC? Because that is a big one, given the Congo Basin is the second largest rainforest in the world.
Watching carefully, you know, I think the moratorium on the allocation of new industrial logging concessions in DRC has been really crucial to sort of hold back that potential expansion of industrial exploitation of DRC's forests. And, you know, it's really important it stays in place. You know, they're such a sort of precious ecosystem, massive reserves of peat underneath as well, recently discovered. So represent a huge sort of ticking carbon time bomb, really.
That was Joe Blackman, head of forest policy and advocacy at Global Witness. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Glasgow. And that's it for this Wednesday, November 30 edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butty in Washington, wishing you a lovely day.